okay, one of the things I want to tell you is this is going to be recorded for those that couldn't make it. So if you do not want to be recorded, we do ask that you hang up at this time. This is the APHL member forum on the CMS rule change regarding the access of laboratory results. Just a couple of housekeeping matters. We have a large number of people that will be on this call, so I will not be taking a roll call, but I do ask that you please be sure that your phone is on mute, unless you're asking a question or providing an answer. When speaking, please identify yourself and your laboratory so we can follow up with you if needed. I'm going to turn this call over to Karen Stillman, QA manager from the North Carolina Public Health Laboratory, as she agreed to lead the call. And we do ask that you all ask your questions, offer your best practices. We want to hear from all of you. Karen, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. Thank you, Karen. I want to welcome everybody. This is a very timely topic, as you all are aware. And I kind of, I guess, started the ball rolling again when I put it, the question up on the QA listserv. We had had a meeting here at North Carolina trying to figure out how was the best way that we could, our concern mostly was verifying the identity of the patient who would be asking for the results and verifying the identity of the authorized, their authorized representative. And we're the only location in North Carolina. We don't have branches, and we probably two-thirds of our population is west of us. So it's not exactly like we can expect somebody to come in and show us their driver's license. So we're very interested in hearing what the other public health staff are, how they're handling this issue as well. And also joining us on this call is Karen Dyer from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the Division of Laboratory Services. And Karen, are you here yet?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you were going to be able to join us from the beginning or not. Karen is here to answer questions about the regulations or to clarify them, items that are specific to CMS and CLIA. But she is not here to give any information on how to implement, this regulation. So, Karen, do you have any introductory remarks that you would like to begin with?
Not that many. Just thank you for having me. The only thing I can, as we said, is really speak to is the CLIA and the CLIA aspect of the regulation. A lot of the questions that I actually got previous to the call pertain more to HIPAA, and I will try to answer them as best I can, but I may have to refer them back to the Office of Civil Rights to get more detailed explanations if I need to. So I know enough about HIPAA now to be a little dangerous, and I don't want to give you the wrong information.
Karen, I have one question, if you don't mind, if I go ahead and just start. One that was asked, and I think a lot of us probably feel this way or have this question, is do we have to educate our clients or advertise that we can now give them their results? Do we have to let them know at the time of sample collection, or is this just something that we put on our privacy practices that are available on our website or however we promote that?
You can always advertise, however. There's nothing that says you can't put up a notice or say that this is available now. But the only thing that you're actually required to do is update your notice of privacy practices.
Okay, that's great. And then the other issue I have is we are expecting our own CLIA survey sometime this next year. Will the CLIA surveyors be specifically looking for to see if we have updated these notices?
I don't believe they would be specifically looking for that. We're still crafting our guidance that we're going to give to our surveyors in regards to this. Most likely what we will have them do is look to see if the lab has a policy or procedure in place.
Okay.
You have until October 6th to come into compliance to get that updated. That would probably be looked at more if you got a HIPAA inspection more so than us.
Okay.
Yeah, we're all
right. That was another question that I had specifically.
Our lab surveyors are going to be looking specifically at the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
They are not going to be surveying on the HIPAA requirements.
Right. I'm going to go ahead and throw this open to the people who are on the call and to see what kind of issues or questions or anything that people would like to ask or talk or share how they have implemented this new CLIA regulation in your facilities. So would anybody like to go ahead and start? And please, like I said, introduce yourselves and the laboratory that you're calling from.
Hi, this is Charlene Thomas calling from the State Lab in Montgomery, Alabama. A bunch of our managers are sitting around the table listening to this, and we wanted to know what was the inspiration for this? Why are we having to give patients results?
Is that for me? I think that the impetus for this came in the move towards electronic health records. To get patients to be more involved in their health care and with the idea that this information could be given to the patient and then they could put it in a personal health record. And then they would have it to go to doctor to doctor to doctor. They wouldn't have to keep calling their physician to get the information. It was basically to further the patient's involvement in their health care.
Hi, this is Jeff Curran from the state of Connecticut. Is this a permissive law, or is this depending on state requirements? For instance, if state law forbids you from releasing the report to a patient, which trumps, federal or state?
If your laboratories are what is called considered covered entities under HIPAA, and we have a list of in the HIPAA privacy rule. And in our rule, I have a smaller list of what would be considered a covered transaction, such as inquiring about a health plan, inquiring about coverage, anything that's done electronically with the lab and a health plan or whatever, that means the lab is a covered entity. And they are required to abide by this law, and this law would trump state law. If the lab does not do anything at all that would be considered a covered transaction. They don't do anything electronically. I can be honest, we never got any comments on that, how many laboratories there were that may do that, so we don't think there's that many of them. In the case of a lab that is not considered a covered entity, they would be abiding by the state law.
This is Catherine in Arizona. Just to follow up on that question, I just wanted to clarify. So when you say a transaction electronically, is that related to billing or is that just related to reporting results?
It could be related to billing. There is a list in the HIPAA privacy and security rule of what are considered covered transactions under HIPAA.
Okay.
If a laboratory does any of those transactions, it is considered a covered entity. And I actually, in the patient access reg, because not all of them pertain to labs, I tried to pull just the ones that pertain to laboratories that were like, you know, billing for contacting the insurance company. Those would be what we would consider the covered transactions.
All right. Would you mind sending that list out on the QA listserv? So kindly pulled that.
I will have to find it in the HIPAA rule and
right.
See if I can get it to you guys.
Thank you.
Roberta, are you on the line by any chance? Roberta?
Yes, I am. I'm on the line. I was just waiting to see how the conversation went.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking. Would you mind just sharing with us what y'all have put into place in South Carolina? I thought maybe it would spur some additional other folks to share their policies as well.
Okay. First of all, I would like to address one thing that you may have a helpful tool in your state that you may be overlooking, and that is working with your legal counsel. they can help address some issues both from a HIPAA point of view as well as the CLIA compliance point of view. And our draft is currently with our legal QA compliance officer for review. But we started developing an HHS CLIA patient right to access laboratory test reports policy, and it's 6 pages long. And it basically goes from the beginning as far as pre-analytic, analytic, and post-analytic. But the main emphasis from the state of South Carolina is that we, too, are the only laboratory per se, but we do have county health departments. And as much as possible, we're going to educate our patients that use our healthcare facilities to go back to the county health department of origin. First of all, they would probably be served a lot faster because they're at the county health department. They can look up all of the records if it has been finalized and released in our computer system. The other thing that we are going to be encouraging is that we did have, and each state is different, we had our legal counsel clarify what was incumbent upon us to demonstrate reasonable identification. And so we have our state requirements for reasonable identification. And so we cannot take any requests over the phone. We can take the call, but we need to request that the person either send us a letter with the required information, or we can send them a form that we already have for release of PHI information. And last but not least, we are still trying to grapple with the what to do if someone actually presents themselves to our physical building, because we are not a public access building because of select agent, and therefore we have some issues with that that we're still working out with security and safety. Okay, I'll be quiet and let other people jump in. Thank you.
Thank you, Roberta. I appreciate you sharing that. Has anyone else gone ahead and been working on their policies or forms?
This is Tammy Tyson. I have a question for Roberta. I'm actually a county entity myself, so you said you're going to encourage them to go to the county. Are you providing the county with the policies and the forms?
Yes, we will. We have a state laboratory procedure manual and QA manual, and we will be providing those as soon as we get a final draft. The other thing that our state law here in South Carolina basically prohibits laboratory professionals, unless they are a clinical board certified pathologist, from doing any interpretation of test results whatsoever. So that's another reason why we are going to encourage the person, if they should call and tell them that they can gain access to that information at the local county health department, plus there are clinical health care providers present that can also assist with any interpretation and or clinical questions that the patient or client may have. But that is not to say that if someone prefers to deal directly with the Bureau of Laboratories, that we will not service that individual and get them the information they request. However, it's our understanding that we do have 30 days to process this information. So we can get the request, and then we can review it, and then we can send it out. Now, I have a question for you all, which throws a little interest in here, and that is, it states in the regulation that we are allowed to release information to a legal representative. I want to know what basically defines a legal representative. Do they have to have power of attorney? Do they have to have medical power of attorney or both? Or are we talking about a mother or father, either adoptive or biological, who is representing a minor child? Okay.
This is Karen. I think a lot of that information, we just touched very briefly on it in the regulation. A lot of that, what constitutes the personal representative and the relationship between parents and minors, is covered under HIPAA in the privacy and security rule, which may be a good starting place if you're trying to get guidance on that.
Thank you. That's what I was hoping you would say, because we have looked at that, and that's what we have formatted our initial approach, but I just wanted to be sure.
Yeah, because we don't spell that out very in much detail. We touch on it in response to some of the questions that we got, but more of that information, and I think we have the references in our reg on where people can go to get more detailed information.
Hello, this is Marty Bame from Michigan, and we had a question. If you are planning to take a call and then send the person a form they need to fill out, which is what we're planning to do, when do you think the 30-day clock should start? When you get the written form back or the date of the call?
This is Roberta Bartholdi from South Carolina. Basically, according to our legal counsel, the 30-day initiates once we get that first contact with our client. Now, you may wish to define it another way, but this is per our legal counsel, the way they wanted to interpret it.
Hi there, this is Linda from Orange County, California. I'm the Deputy County Privacy Officer here. I have a question here. We also are a local government agency, and who our lab department is actually a cover component under HIPAA for our agency and our county, but they don't see directly clients. You know, they're providing services mostly for our clinics and maybe contracted staff and maybe sometime hospital. But we also have a department called the Custodial Records Department who handles all the processing. That's our policy, is to send everybody there for processing of any records requests they want. So we're wondering if we'd be able to comply with this regulation if, like, clients still can get their record, their lab reports, but they can go through Custodial Records instead of coming to the lab directly themselves, because, yes, it's inaccessible to the public.
If that's what you have, this is Karen, if that's what you have in your policy and that's what you have it set up, that's how you get patients get their access, that should be fine.
Okay. And then since HITECH just came out, we updated our MPP already, so would this need to be added, like, by October again, or can we maybe send out maybe a one-page memo, or how does that work until we get our next renewal? But this is a substantial change, so I think technically you guys require us to change our MPP again?
Well, we kind of addressed that too. HIPAA didn't require the privacy practices. They were going to give everybody time knowing that our rule was coming out. So if you've already done it based on HIPAA and you haven't done it based on our rule, yeah, you're going to have to revise it again by October 6th.
October 6th. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, they were trying to give everybody enough time, and I think they actually said that in the HIPAA privacy rule, that they were going to do some discretion as to when that was. But now you have, if you haven't done it for hours or you did it for the one, you're going to have to do it again. We tried to help.
Okay, yeah, and I think they allow us maybe to just at least post the electronic record first. I mean, electronic document. So we can make the change and have it accessible via the web and then mail it out eventually.
Right. Whatever your, if you have it, you have to have something
in place that says this is what you're going to do.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Karen Sanderson. I actually found the information that was in the frequently asked questions that CMS put out in regards to the persons who qualify as a are the persons who qualify as a person designated by the individual in accordance with the HIPAA privacy rule. That's at subpart 164.524(c)(3ii). So it's actually, and if you look at the frequently asked questions that you can get off of the CLIA website, it's under item number 9 is where that information is listed and the reference. Hope that helps. I have another question because I think CLIA, the regulations do say that you can charge for the, like if you have to buy a disc or, you know, whatever physical pieces it takes in order to get these reports out, you can charge a small fee.
Right.
Are any of the other public health labs doing that? Or have we gotten to that far so far?
Yeah, there are certain things you can charge for.
Yeah.
For that, and we do spell that out as well.
Yeah. The other thing that we were thinking about doing is funneling, at least we are hoping that this will not be a large amount of requests for lab results, and that to at least begin with, we will funnel those requests to like one person to handle that. It's also our person who handles our records requests, our FOIAs, and we would start with it in that way so that we have a better way of verifying patient identity and forms and getting things set up. Is that how a lot of other places are planning to handle it?
This is Roberta in South Carolina, and that's exactly how we're going to handle it. And we have one additional thing. We are going to photocopy exactly what we send to the requester, and they will so that the original documents can go back on file like a requisition or something, and those particular files will be kept in a secure file that will be labeled so that we will know that this is the files that we have sent out, so that if we get audited by HIPAA, we can actually pull specifically those files. And also, just in case we have, obviously there are different timelines between CLIA inspection and maintenance of records versus HIPAA requirements, and so we decided to do it that way. Thank you.
This is Tony Ivasek with the North Carolina State Lab. I am that legal representation person that's doing these requests. I do have some serious questions about specifically verifying the individual requesting that information. When I deal with a legal request, I have a law firm. I have a title. I have risk and liability obtained with that particular request. If I get these patient requests, how do I validate a patient that I've never seen, that it is their information that I'm releasing to them? And if not, how do I go backwards and help defend that later if I happen to give it out to a person that indiscriminately took upon themselves to gather their patient's information? I'll just use a Facebook example recently of somebody posting her boyfriend's STD results on the Facebook page.
Oh, that's nice.
So that's my question from the legal side. Because we do not get to see these patients, it makes it very difficult to validate it is this person who I'm releasing these results to.
All right.
Any comments? You know, one, I don't know how many people saw it, but AACC came out in their April edition of the Clinical Laboratory News. They had a really good article on patients getting direct access to lab reports and how should labs prepare. And they had some of the best information from a practical standpoint that I've seen in any of the other documents. And one thing that had been mentioned somewhere was notary. You know, do you need to get a notarized request? That's just one option that's been thrown out.
Now, this is Willie Andrews from the DCLS Virginia State Lab, and that's actually what we are planning to do. We're going to have a form that has to be submitted, and it has to be notarized. Actually, it was also commented to us that another option might be to require a copy of the driver's license in lieu of notaries. I don't know about anybody else, though, but our Virginia driver's license are so I don't know, there's like holograms and so much different, you know, the way they're made now, I don't know that we would even get a Xerox copy that we could read. So we're planning to use a notarized form.
This is Karen. I would caution, I understand the idea of the notary. I would caution you, and you may want to get in touch with the Office of Civil Rights, because the whole idea behind this is not to make it overly burdensome on a patient. Requiring a notary may be considered burdensome by some patients. Mm-hmm. So I would actually run that by the Office of Civil Rights to make sure that they are okay with that before you put it into place.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying, but how do we know that this person who's requesting these results are who they say they are?
This is Linda from Orange County again. I think under the regulations, you have to have a policy on how you can verify identity, and even in state regulations, I think for California we do. And so if you have a policy on what you require as your, you might seek counsel opinion as well, but, you know, what you need to do to identify this person, what kind of couple of identification, you may need to see their password, your identification, or if they don't have password, because a lot of our clientele don't have that, or their social security number. The more data you can gather to verify, the better it'll hold up. I mean, there's no right or wrong, but I think you have to have a policy already in place now to verify client that comes in. Mm-hmm. So for the lab, like for our lab, we would use the same agency policy, county policy.
This is Roberta Bartholdi in South Carolina again. Basically, our legal counsel has advised us as to what our state requirements are for reasonable identification. And it basically, if someone is going to commit fraud, then as long as we are consistent with our policies for the identification of this individual, and they're basically, it's the same as what we require when an individual presents themselves for services at our county health departments, then our legal counsel basically says that we will be able to defend that position, that if somebody actually committed fraud to obtain results, that we would not be held liable. Thank you.
In Georgia, our legal counsel has taken the same stance that they're going to handle the request. We just pass them on to them, and they'll verify the person's identity through whatever they normally do when they get requests, because they get requests now for various things. But that doesn't solve the issue of once they've verified that this person is who they say they are, how do you verify in a laboratory, match up the test results? Because we may not have the information that we're not going to have driver's license information. We may not have social security numbers. So there's still the issue of once your legal counsel has said, okay, this person has a right to this information, how do we identify which lab reports are theirs? Or if it's a newborn screening, if it's a parent, you know, who which ones do they have rights to. So that's, from the laboratory perspective, that's still going to be, I think, an issue. And sure, you can ask for date of birth, last name, maybe even date of service, you know, those kinds of things, but I don't know. We're not sure how that's going to play out.
This is Roberta Bartholdi from South Carolina again. Basically, those questions that you have stated are the ones that at the Bureau of Laboratories we still have issues with, even though our counsel assures us that it would be appropriate. We, too, are going to be sending all of the initial requests either by letter or by telephone contact or the submission of our form to the legal counsel. And if they say that we can proceed with the information, then they are going to guide us, because even if someone wants, like if we get a subpoena on a patient's chart, they have to be very specific as to what test or what time period are you requesting. So the legal counsel may get back in touch with the individual asking if they, you know, do they want their entire medical laboratory testing, or do they just want certain tests, et cetera. Those questions, I think, are, unfortunately, we're finding that we may have to modify our policy as we come up against scenarios. Thank you.
This is Karen Sanderson again. I'm going to throw another rock in the pond here. For my personal position, I go to a Duke practice, and Duke over here has set up so that they have an electronic health exchange so that I can actually go online and get my results. And I just wonder if that's not the intent that they were trying to come up with, that, you know, I know a lot of laboratories are trying to come up with electronic patient portals that you can go into to get your results. If you create a patient portal and set up access through that, would that meet the intent of this regulation?
I believe so. There are a lot of people that Kaiser is one of them.
Yeah.
It has a very active and well-used portal. I mean, you still have to have processes in place to make sure that who the person is who the person is. So you don't get away from verifying in some way that the person should have access. But I think, I don't know if it was the intent of how the regs came about, but I think it would certainly make it a little bit easier for the laboratories in the long run if it is done electronically.
Yeah. Because we have some electronic reporting, but it's not set up in the, it's not set up like a patient portal, not like Duke and a lot of the other providers
right.
around here have.
Right, and it would take a long, you know, it's going to take a while for people to get to the point where they could do that. Not everybody's going to be able to do that right off the bat, because it takes a lot of time and money to do.
I had another question that was actually posed to us ahead of time, is that if there is testing that is, and I don't think this is actually covered under CLIA, but it's, if we're doing testing that is court-ordered or forensic, does it fall under these requirements?
It ties into whether, if the laboratory is what's considered a covered entity, then that patient could go to the lab and actually get their results. I actually sent that one to the Office of Civil Rights because I wasn't sure. And HIPAA, in a lot of cases, does not have jurisdiction over courts.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to tie into whether the lab itself is a covered entity, in which case the patient could go on their own and access it and request it. But I think under the court system, a court can get pretty much anything anyway.
Okay.
Because we had a question about the courts and about, I guess, the Federal Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, which was a learning for me. I didn't have any idea what that was. And I think it's the same case if the laboratory that's doing the testing for the school is a covered entity, then the patient, again, could get their results. But generally, the family education rights applies to school records, not to HIPAA.
Karen, does that also, if it's not for diagnostic purposes, is it still covered?
That's, you know, this was a really a very hairy area for us because we, you know, we're very specific as to what we cover for, like, drug testing under CLIA. And I have not really gotten a good answer to my satisfaction as to how that relates to this. I'll be honest. I think what I got back from OCR just kind of confused it. So I want to actually do some more follow-up on that one. Because we really, you know, if it's, you know, for we basically spot pre-employment, it would not be covered under CLIA, but if it's for drug monitoring and therapy and that kind of thing, it would be. So when it's outside of labs and outside of those situations, I need to get some more clarification.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Karen Breckenridge had told me just before we went on the air that I think it's Oregon has posted their document on the Member Resource Center, and I really appreciate them sharing this. I would please, you know, just remind everybody that as you develop things, if you could share those on the Member Resource Center, it would be greatly appreciated to all of us. Anybody else have any questions or comments? Has this been helpful?
Yes, very.
Yes, this has been very helpful. Thank you.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Would it be worthwhile? Do you think you would like to have another call in, say, a month or, you know, 4 to 6 weeks just for a follow-through to see how labs are doing? Would that be helpful to folks?
Yes.
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 Yes, it would.
It would be very helpful.
Either Karen, do you have any comments or questions that you want to go ahead and express?
No, I was just going to offer that Karen has my email address if she wants to, you know, if anybody has any questions or things they want to try to get clarified, you know, you can send them to me and I'll try to answer them as best I can. And if I can't, I will send them to OCR and get a response best I can for them. So I just wanted to offer that to everybody.
Thanks, Karen.
You know, if you see things posted and you see red flags, perhaps it would be nice to have on the member board something like an FAQ, except frequently observed pitfalls.
And we are happy to have you post anything on the Member Resource Center.
That's one of the items I had thought about is that if anybody goes ahead and has implemented this and has any, has had a learning curve or has had any items that pro and con that they would like to pass along to others, I think it'd be greatly appreciated.
So feel free to use the QA listserv for that and or the Member Resource Center to help you then use that.
And Karen, is there any additional comments?
I'd be very interested in finding out if the notary is going to be acceptable or not. I'm not sure who's following up on that.
This is Karen. I can send that to OCR.
That would be awesome. Thank you.
That would be great. Thank you. Is there anything else?
Karen Dyer, if it's okay with you, I will put your email out on the QA listserv for the group.
That's fine.
Thank you for that.
And I will find the information or get the information on the list of covered transactions and send that to you.
Great. Anything that you do send, Karen, I can put on the listserv for the group.
Okay, great.
And thank you all for your participation today, and Karen Sanderson for agreeing to lead the call. If you are interested in additional topics, please let us know, and we can do a follow-up in about a month.
All right. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.